Yeah, I'm just recording it now, Ted.
Oh, okay, right. So, as everybody except Robert knows, we are a rather free and easy group. We ask questions whenever we like, and we can often continue discussion well after April's Pride. So, with that warning, crush it.
So, I'm Robert Wazarski, and so I've started working for my company in Medimin as a preclinical development as a senior physician. Then later on, after 3 years up there, I moved to AstraZeneca clinical site. Afterwards, I'm working with GSK right now. So this work is basically comes from my years when I was working for Medimin in preclinical development. And so, well, two different sides of drug development, preclinical and clinical. The differences. This is just as an introduction. I will not spend that much time on introduction because probably it's something pretty well known for you about the differences. So hopefully I'll go through very fast through the introduction side. So preclinical and clinical development, both sides of drug development. So basically focusing on safety and efficacy testing on the clinical side, there's more focus on particular compounds. So if you see, for example, maybe start with this nice kind of graph, you see this is a clinical development where you get only 5 compounds before it being coming from 150 different compounds in preclinical development, only 2% of them gets to the clinical side. So you can see the differences. In the clinical side, it's probably more focused. Studies are bigger and more thoroughly designed. There's a huge emphasis on the design itself, on specifying endpoints. The endpoints are established, and there's use of external data in form of the meta-analysis. From a statistical point of view, it's pretty much structured. We got the guidelines, we got the expectations, we know exactly what to do on the clinical side, right? On the preclinical side, there are more compounds, animal studies or in vivo studies. Study themselves are smaller, right? Only 10 animals per arm, treatment arm. Different type of experiments, pretty much exploratory character of the studies. And this makes a lot of data gets collected in-house, and from a statistical point of view, it's kind of, there's much more freedom about application of statistical methods as far as they serve the right purpose. So, these are the differences, and statisticians, as I said, got more freedom on the preclinical side.
You mentioned there's more freedom on the preclinical side. The stage at which you go from the preclinical to the clinical, are there established guidelines of when that's acceptable, when that's right to do?
I've never get to this point when I became a part of this submission to investigate new investigative drug, right? Right. So it's normally drugs go to clinical site when there is very strong evidence in the preclinical that the drug really works. So my opinion, there is no much need for kind of showing statistical evidence, right, as far as you see it's working. It needs to be it needs to be really strong effect such that the drug gets accepted to clinical development. Because normally what we observe on the clinical side, it's a huge kind of, it's comes back to the mean, right? It reverts to the mean. So the huge peak effect size on the preclinical side goes down in the clinical. So there is no much, I haven't seen that much translational kind of issue between preclinical and clinical. So if something leaves preclinical, the evidence is crystal clear that the drug works. There are probably guidelines how it's supposed to look at the statistical evidence, but I can't really tell you much about that. I've been pretty much working on this exploratory site when there have been a lot of compounds, a lot of experiments going on, and so we had to do something with the data, and I'll tell you more about what's really being done, right, and for this time being, and where we need to improve and what could be done, right? That's pretty much what we might talk about. But yeah, probably there are some sort of kind of guidelines how is that exactly supposed to look like if you do this new drug application, so basically something goes to the clinic or something. So, right. Basically, the way it works is scientists come to, in preclinical development, scientists, biologists come to statisticians and ask for help. For help in designing the studies or analysis of the data itself. And statisticians are supposed to come with some sort of solutions. So basically, there are certain criteria. These are my criteria, my personal subjective criteria in the choice of statistical methods if you want to kind of talk to the scientists, talk to the biologists. Do you have any biologists or scientists today? Right, okay. That's good, because you know exactly the other side, right? So first of all, in my opinion, simplicity. It's a key issue. We need to kind of, we need to be aware that we are talking to people who don't know statistics, right? So we can't really overwhelm with the statistical terminology. We need to give them something which is intuitive, easy to understand, but does the job. And as I said, there are a lot of data generated in-house, so we need to be able to use the data in our decisions as a prior information or some kind of reference whenever we choose some statistical methodology to go on the way of the analysis of the data. Right, so the methods should be applicable in analysis itself, right? So it should, as I said, that job, but also be applicable in the study design, because later on, if you talk about some endpoints from our statistical models, they will come later on, right? So the model itself is supposed to analyze data on the same model. I mean, one model, the same model should be used in the design the study as well as if you analyze the data, because probably the endpoint comes from the model itself. So the model itself needs to be able to kind of, do both, analyze the data and design the study. So we need to be able to get the right endpoints, be able to specify the effect size and run simulations on the model as well. And the last element is some kind of ability to translate, right? So methods which work in a preclinical as well as on the clinical side, to find some sort of translational value of our results. That's not really, it's important, but it's not that easy, right? It's not that easy. So this preclinical and clinical experiments are pretty much different in nature. So talking about some translational issue, it's a big topic, right? But in general, it could be nice to have the model which works on both sides, because at least we got some common platform we can compare preclinical efficacy, preclinical outcomes, and clinical outcomes using the same model, the same endpoints, for example, right? It's much easier later on to think about some sort of translational issues for our study. What we can do, we can choose the novel methods, or we can use the existing ones in some creative way. I prefer the latter one. There are a lot of methods, but not of them are really discovered to be used in a data analysis in drug development. I'll give you an oncology example. So what's normally preclinical statisticians get faced? So this is example outcome from in vivo efficacy study in preclinical development in oncology. So how does it start? We got our tumor, right? We got our tumor cells of interest to be able to find the drug for, right? We select animals for our study. We implant tumors on them, let the tumor grow, and then we randomize them among the treatment groups. In this particular study, we got 5 different drugs administrated on 2 different dosing levels, plus 3 control arms. the placebo one and two controlled treatments, right? So once the animals get randomized among treatment groups, the drug gets administered, let's say on day four. Day one, then tumors being implanted, and day four, grown enough to be for treatment to be administered. So once the treatment gets administered, we observe tumor volumes on the particular days. Some of the tumors don't respond. They come pretty much from the control groups. They keep on growing, right, because there is no treatment administered to the tumor. For the other ones, they respond. However, you see by the colors mean the individual tumors within the treatment groups. If you look at the whole picture, it's kind of, yeah, there's a lot of heterogeneity. So what's really going on? I mean, once the tumor is reaching a certain level, for the ethical reasons, animals get culled. Some of them survive up to the end. So 78th day was planned, end of the experiment. Right? So all the animals get culled here, so basically they die. That's the way it is. That's the requirement to use animals in the experiments. And that's the outcome. So basically the question, there are of course questions behind this study, but in general, standard question is about efficacy. I got my drug on a different dosing level, I got my control, is my drug efficacy? Is there efficacy from my treatment, from one of these treatments with respect to the control arm, placebo or control treatment, or with the other drugs used as a reference, right? Is there any kind of, you know, efficacy? That's the first question. Looking at the data, it's like a jungle. There's a lot of heterogeneity, especially in the placebo group. And the idea is to get out of the jungle alive, right? So what's being done is pretty much this one. So let's consider for each day the outcomes. Let's take the average within the group and plus minus standard error. And that picture becomes more clear now. So we see these are the control arms. So tumor volume grows. These are the treatment arms. There are different patterns.
I'm having a little difficulty distinguishing what is represented by each curve. I think the placebo is the one which is topmost at the beginning.
So you can say this, yes, this is by looking at the colors, yeah, probably, maybe this one is a placebo. I think this one is a placebo, it's kind of.
Oh.
Anyway.
Then what is the top one at the beginning?
This is control treatment. Another control treatment, which by default doesn't work.
The control treatment is not this one.
It's a control, so there's a placebo, so nothing gets administered. Tumor volume goes without any treatment, but on the outside there is also some kind of treatment, which we know doesn't work, but we want to see how it works. Yes, so, but it's from the like experimental point of view, this is control one, so we don't expect the tumor volume will be kind of reacting to the treatment.
I mean, yeah, by looking at the picture, it would look like the control was worse than the placebo.
Yes, that's fine. This is the nature of experiment. I don't know what exactly was the scientific question behind this one. What are these control treatments? That's a kind of general idea, how it looks like. Yes, so maybe it's, the treatment goes worse. But if you come back to the previous picture, can you say the same? They're pretty much mixed up down here. Right? So this is like a cloud of this control treatments. So there is a lot of heterogeneity. Once we take the mean, that becomes kind of clear, but I wouldn't get pretty much attached to this picture because this is just the mean. And if you take the mean, you know, make it representative. The distribution needs to be normal within the groups.
Yeah, and the error bars, I get the standard error of the mean.
Yeah. So it's my idea, just showing you this picture, it's what's basically being done right now. Yes, so that's what's a basic kind of practice if you want to analyze this data. So the question is, let's pick up one of these control arms, yes, so whether it's placebo or the control treatment, and say, are my treatments, is there a more efficacy from my treatment compared to the control? That's one question. Or another question is there an efficacy from between the treatments. Yes, if you say, for example, this one is one of these two treatments, it's my reference treatment, do I improve with kind of increasing the dose or going for the other treatment? There is some kind of, you know, there is a connection between these treatments, so they got something in common, and there are very strict scientific questions choosing these treatments, choosing the dosing levels to answer, right? I don't want to concentrate now on the questions. But obviously there is something going on here, right? So the controls, choice of the control arms, and choice of the placebo, and choice of this treatment. So this is just kind of idea, what's being done, kind of how does it look like, and what's being done. So in general, if we kind of, for this time being, the common practice is, let's say, if you want to check whether some of these treatments, there is more efficacy compared to the placebo, one of these days, pre-specified days, is taken into account, and we take this simple test, compare the values between observed in the particular day in the control arm and on the treatment arm, right, and see whether there is a significance. If there is a significance, means yeah, probably it's more there is efficacy, right. We can go also for ANOVA tests, so some parametric testing, non-parametric testing, depending on the assumptions.
But you have an issue with sensitive there, because the ones which have a high growth rate get killed immediately. So obviously we've got to truncate the distribution. So that's complicated.
It's complicated. So it's in general the draw, yes. There are a lot of complicated issues from statistical point of view. First of all, heterogeneity. First, second, sample size. Only, let's say, here we got 10 animals for a treatment arm. A lot of heterogeneity. Third one, it's, distributional issues, right? Whether we got the distributions for our testing and what sort of distribution it is. And, So the methods, as I said, so as you see, kind of, you know, if you want to go for some simple testing, and this experiment costs £100,000, just using only one day information to kind of make this decision about efficacy, it's rather kind of squandering money. So yeah, we can say analyze on a particular day, or take some kind of, you know, time to certain things to happen, like, you know, if the tumor volumes get doubled or tripled. Right, and then do some kind of Kaplan-Meier time to event analysis. So what I can tell you, in my practice, I've seen the first one used a lot. That's a pretty much common practice. Sometimes I've seen the second one, but I've never seen anything else. What could be anything else? Anything else is kind of doing some analysis of the dynamics here, right? So to get to this point, for example, on the day 70, to observe this one, there was a trajectory, right? So the tumor volume was following some trajectory to end up here. So using only this information, as I said, it's squandering money. It's better kind of, you know, make more use out of the data. So what we can do some kind of curve fitting, check linear, non-linear trends, splines, lowest approximations, right? But they, we need to find the language with the scientists, with the biologists, such that they understand what's really going on. We can apply some fancy modeling, but that's really not questions whether they will be kind of understandable by the scientists.
The point which I am perceiving in that left-hand diagram, I don't know whether it's part of what you're going to say, but if you take the lower group curves, there is one group of three, one group of four.
Yeah.
In each group,
the
curves are close together from time around 28 to time around 49.
Yeah. Yes. You mean this one, right?
Yes. Each one is in a narrow band.
Yes.
Over that time interval.
Yes.
Now that strikes me as slightly more than just a coincidence. Is there a biological feature lurking in there?
Probably. I mean, that's kind of, yeah, well, these are the treatment arms. As you see, tumor volumes are responding to the treatment, right? This arm just grow, right? There is no response. This one's response in the beginning, then regrow. This one responds completely. I mean, why they come up over here together, right? Yes, so maybe that's kind of a reflection point for this certain biological process, right? So if you, so because as you see, some of them stay responsive, right? Some of them start regrowing very slowly. So there is an inhibition in the beginning, and then there is a reflection point. So there is a time to... The reflection point here, it's kind of maybe slightly earlier than the reflection point here. So there are... Yes, I agree. There are a lot of kind of, you know, fissures.
Which it could be that the various treatments and doses are such that a certain group of treatments and doses bring you close together around about day 30.
Yeah.
And at a certain level, and another group bring you close together at a different level.
Absolutely right. That's very kind of important observation, because that's something I'm gonna concentrate with my model. Time to something, time to the regrowth, or time of the reflection point between the inhibition and regrowth. This is, but if you kind of know, if you notice, this something can't be picked up by these two approaches, which are pretty common in the industry. Industry just concentrates on the static analysis for a particular day. They don't care about the dynamics that much, because it includes modeling. Modeling is not that easy. There is no one model on the market. There are plenty of models. All of them are doing the job. And all of them kind of, you know, the more complex, the more difficult to be applied, right? So this, the third point, it's not touched that much, but maybe that's the way to go. But we need to find a model which is good enough for statisticians to make them happy, to pick up all of these kind of features you talk about, as well for the biologists to be understandable. And so simple enough to understandable and doing the job from statistics point of view.
Just to rephrase what you have said, this choice of the method depends on the aim. If the aim in this experiment was to find a single drug that being stable response, then I would go for first method at the end of it.
Yeah.
If the aim of this was to distinguish stable responses, response from non-stable response, then it would be trajectory. So it's biology that says to you what you want.
But that's something kind of, that's some kind of a priori knowledge which might be taken into account at the design stage. What sort of methods we want to go? What sort of method we want to go such that it will be applicable in the study design, such that particular endpoints and effect sizes will be able to specify, right? If it's just kind of something about a particular point, we can choose static analysis and say t-test, that's the effect we expect, power, that's the sample size we wanna go for. But if you wanna look at something else, so for example time, some sort of dynamics of the tumor you observe. Because as I said, these four treatments are pretty kind of equal to each other, as well as these three treatments. They get pretty much the same dynamics. But there is something in the dynamics we need to be picked up by the model we apply, right? Some method, we need to know what sort of method to apply such that we'll pick up these characteristics. So, so the language and communication between statisticians and biologists is really important. And that's, please bear in mind, once you see the other slides coming up. This is, we are basically in one or two in the methods applied these days. And anything else you will see, it's something new, which is supposed to serve the purpose. Should be easy to understand, should speak biology, and should make statisticians happy. This is just the picture, what we observe. We observe growth. If you want to look at the dynamics, I don't want to look at this kind of, you know, static analysis. If you want to look at the dynamics of the tumor volume, what we can expect. Looking at this kind of example experiment, there are millions of experiments like that on the market now, This is just a picture, but I think the picture pretty much gives you the standard types of the responses you can observe. You can observe the growth if it's just a control arm. Tumor is growing. There is no response in the treatment. And you response and you observe the treatment arms. Some of them respond. Yeah. So since the very beginning of the treatment, tumor is shrinking and stays low at the end of the study. Some of them go down, so there is an inhibition, but there is a regrowth. Regrowth happens earlier in some arms compared to the other arms. Which one is better? I think the better is one of the delayed response, right? The delayed regrowth, right? As well as the strength of the regrowth itself, right? As you see, this one is pretty much kind of regrowing in the same rate as the control ones compared to these two, which regrow, but at a slower rate. So there are certain dynamics we need to capture, and we need a model now. There was a question, right?
So I'm just going to make the point that I work in phase one, and I see that those kinds of plots all the time. And the people who decide to put investment in, the higher up people decide that they're going to invest in this drug, that's what they're looking at. They don't look at the statistical people.
That's exactly the point, and that's exactly the kind of answer to your question. If the drug goes to the clinical, Now imagine this is the control arm, and this is the control, let's say, this is the control arm, so this is our drug. It won't go to the clinic because the effect is too small. Even though it's statistically significant, it's simply too small. I would say these two drugs will go to the clinic, the very bottom ones. And that's a clistrical case. So in the end, in the exploratory phase, you can play statistics, we can do different things, we can kind of choose, do they do the statistics. But when it comes to the clinic, we need to have a very strong evidence that the drug is working. Yeah? So maybe you don't even need statistics, you just need the pretty pictures, which tell you the truth, what's going on, right? But the real picture is here. This is the real picture. So the treatments we are talking about, which work, they're over here. You see, they are still kind of heterogeneous. This is the control arm. This is the control cloud. Everything is here is a control. So yeah, well, if you want to kind of compare these drugs with the controls, they're not that far away. So if you want to kind of translate, these drugs, they look very nice on this plot, right? They still separate from the control, but if someone tells you this is the picture, that's where we really are, I would say that I'm not that far away. So I wouldn't take this drug to the clinic. So that's pretty much kind of 0-1 assessment. Yeah, p-values, significance is one side, statistics, but on the other side is just the picture we see, and see what's going on.
So I was going to ask you a few questions. Is this plot on the same scale, vertical scale, as the other one? That's going from.
I think so, because
that's going from 0 to 750.
So it's they're on the same scale, but it's the upper limit. It's not the same kind of.
Yeah.
Because we take the standard errors here, so they naturally narrow down the heterogeneity we observe in a real bit.
But both of them are the same variable, tumor volume. But one is ranging from 0 to just under 1,000, and the other is ranging from 0 to, again, just under 1,000. Yes. So they are in fact on the same scale.
This is the same scale, but the upper limit is not 1,200 on this on the left-hand side. So you're right, probably I should put them on the same scale.
Oh, sorry, they're going up by 300 on the right.
This picture doesn't on this picture you can see this is kind of the feature of the ggplots in R, always take the upper limit. If you don't specify it, it will take this upper limit as the maximum observed one. Yeah. So for this one, maximum observed, mean or standard error is let's say 800 something. Here, maximum real tumor volume observed is around 1200. Right. Normally 1200 is where the animals get culled. Right. So they. Due to ethical reasons, yeah, so because they can't. Anyway, so That's the data, that's the statistics, that's where we are normally with our analysis, and that's where we want to be. We do want to do some kind of, you know, overall dynamics analysis, and we want to speak biological language. So, Haitian, in one of the papers, this paper is a response to one of the statistical papers where the statisticians propose some kind of modeling framework for in vivo, following Bayesian change point, Bayesian hierarchical model of the change point analysis. Pretty complicated, but the model itself is pretty much about putting the part of inhibition part as one model, then change point, inhibition growing part of the other model. So some kind of analysis like that. And that's a response to this kind of opinion about this paper provided by Haitian. Daniel Haitian, he's a statistician. He's really well-known person in this kind of preclinical area. And he's really good, he's a technical statistician, but a statistician who speaks biology. And in response to this paper, he said, yep, that's a nice paper, nice model, very kind of sophisticated, but it doesn't speak biology. So he said,
excuse me, I'm slightly puzzled by this because you have one curve which is body of living cells, one curve which is body of dead cells.
Now, so what?
The volume of dead cells is decreasing.
Yes, yeah. So I'll describe this picture. So let me come to the point, okay? So what Haitian says, okay, we've got a sophisticated model. Looks good, but it's too complicated. It doesn't speak biology. In response to that, he says, what we already observe is tumor volume. In the very beginning, imagine this is when it gets implanted on the animal, or animal, so let's stop. It's about from in vivo experimental, from in vivo experiment point of view. So we got tumor volume, gets implanted, grows up to the point when the treatment gets administered, right? So tumor volume. Tumor volume in his model consists of the volume of the living cells, living tumor cells, and the volume of the dead cells, right? Here, after the treatment administration, volume of the dead cells is zero, because there is no treatment to kill them. So all of them, so the tumor is growing. Tumor cells multiply, grow, tumor grows, right? We assume that it grows at an exponential rate. That's pretty much assumption in the literature. Exponential growth rate is it's an assumption for the tumor growth. Here the treatment gets administrated. So number of the dead cells, so we assume that the effect is like a very, it's kind of immediate effect, right? Treatment gets administrated and automatically it kills 80% of the tumor cells. Kills them, the cells get cleared out on exponential way as well. Right?
What is the mechanism for clearing out?
So they shrink and they shrink up to zero and get cleared from the organism. So it's kind of, you know, they disappear, right? Tumor volume, total tumor volume is a sum of the volume of the living cells and the volume of the dead cells. But they don't just disappear. They need to be cleared out from the bubble. Yes, they get cleared out in exponential rate. The remaining ones still keep on growing. Yeah, the blue one. So, in the end, we observe like a sum. Again, from the very beginning, you observe the sum of the living cells and the dead cells. After the treatment gets administered, we observe the same, but what we observe is pretty much the composition of the volume of the living cells and the volume of the dead cells. Such that, in the end, we observe that curve, which pretty much consists of the volume of the dead cells and the volume of the living cells, which both decay on the exponential rate, dead ones, and the living ones increase and grow on exponentially. Yeah.
So I thought in the picture you showed us before, it was continuous treatment.
It was what?
Continuous treatment for Is it just for a single dose?
Yes. That's a simplification. Sometimes it's just one treatment which lasts for, so let's say there's a treatment, coming back to this picture. Could be that the treatment period, I don't know exactly the details for this experiment, but it could be that the treatment continues between day 4 and day 11, and then it stops. It's not like they treat them for all of the time, for the whole time domain. Normally it's kind of for first couple of days, and then see what's going on. It could be that day 4 is the end of the treatment, when they really start counting the effect.
Because if you're thinking about biology, I mean, here you are blaming that the inflection point on just the volumes of living and death. But it could be also a feedback or something like
that. Yeah, absolutely.
So it would be interesting to see the time scales of response to the...
I agree, but that's... I want to keep it simple, just to show you some kind of mechanism which we may expect. Then, on top of that, we can build, we can add the element of the time of the treatment, when the treatment starts, when the treatment ends, and the effects observed, because it could be that the tumor volume, the responsive cells, goes up over the treatment period to go down later on, right? But the tumor starts swallowing, which means it's reacting, which means it's responding to the treatment. But the very first phase of the response is like, grow, tumor volume grows, and then such that, and to go down, right? To shrink later on. So yeah, I agree. There are plenty of other things we can consider here, but in general, it's kind of very simple mechanism. Yes, see what's going on. So that's a Haken. He said that's sort of model, which kind of gives you some kind of dynamics over time, describes dynamics over time in a biological way, right? Assumption of the growth rate, inhibition, two processes overlap, superimpose on each other, such that the tumor volume you observe is a kind of, we can decompose it into tumor volume from growing cells, which are the living tumor cells, and kind of shrinking cells, which are cells, those cells who respond to the treatment. Independently, I found Stein, who is a biologist from National Institute of Health in America. He came with this kind of model, right? So we got two independent approaches. Haken says that could be something we want to do, and Stein says let's quantify, let's describe it in the model form. So he's proposing something called growth inhibition model. Originally, he calls it growth regression model. Growth regression model. However, when I talked to my colleagues from MedImmune, they said in this particular situation, if you want to talk about oncology, it's better to say inhibition instead of regression. So I said growth inhibition model for me. Right? So in this model, it concentrates on the tumor volume again. So it's pretty much about oncology application. He says, if you observe the tumor volume on the particular time point and we normalize it to the baseline value is normally the moment, time when the treatment gets administered, right? So we normalize to the volume at the administration points. Coming back to our data, let's say our point of the treatment administration probably will be day 4. So every treatment volume gets divided by the volume, by the value for the baseline. Right? So we created this sort of FT, which is pretty much the normalized tumor volume. And he says the whole process could be seen as a sum of two independent processes. Process of the growth, exponential growth with the constant growth rate G, T stands for time, E is a exponential, right? Constant. So growth process plus inhibition process, right? Minus D. D is an inhibition rate. So minus D is actually inhibition rate because it means it goes down. Yes, it's kind of exponential after the minus value, right? So that's part of the inhibition. Minus 1. So we got in our tumor volume, two processes, process of the growth, exponential growth, and the process of exponential inhibition. Minus one because this model can split into two submodels. If you got just inhibition, so growth rate equals zero, e power zero equals one minus one, we end up with just inhibition model. And the other way around, once we got just inhibition model, sorry, once we got just growth model, where inhibition parameter, inhibition rate is zero, then we end up with e power gt, right? He calls, that's the kind of baseline model. For the purpose of oncology analysis, they come up with another model, kind of extended GI model, where they introduce the fraction of the cells which respond to the treatment, sensitive to the treatment. You can call it like a death rate, right? So the fraction of the cells which died, right? So basically cells, fraction of the cells which will contribute to the inhibition part of the tumor volume, right? So 1 minus phi will be the living cells, phi will be the fraction of the dead cells, right? So this model, the extended model, could be also presented as just the inhibition model or just the growth model if we take particular values of the phi into account, right? So inhibition model, all of them die, right? Phi equals 100% of phi equals 1. So all the tumor cells died, we observe just the inhibition process. So on the other side, if none of them died, we observe just the growth process. So here is like these two models we got from putting appropriate phi value into the model, right? So we got two different types of model, growth inhibition model and its full or extended version, which end up into the same type of the submodels. I kind of understand the first model, where does it come from? It's a bit mystery for me when this model comes from. It's not statistical model, so it's some kind of biological model proposed by biologists, which could be applied into statistical analysis. That's my way of interpretation for this model. It's not statistical, it doesn't come from the evidence such that they say, well, I mean, we fit the data and this sort of model fits best, right, out of the whole set of different models, exponential growth inhibition models we have, right? This one is the best. No, they say, this is the model, yes? This is the model which kind of describes certain process. We could be model without this inhibition and the growth rate, it could be model with, could be model just with the inhibition and growth rate, could be model with inhibition, growth rate, and the death rate as well, so the proportion of the cells which died.
I think this goes back to the earlier question, what happens to the dead cells? Because your F of T is the tumor volume.
It's normalized, yeah.
Those cells which have died some time ago have smaller volume now than they did then, although they are still dead.
They get smaller, they shrink. That's why the whole volume becomes kind of smaller.
But you are therefore dealing, I think, with just a single treatment, a single time of treatment. And this has one effect at one point in time on any cell.
That's right.
And if the cell survives, it survives and it can divide, and that is the E to the GT.
So you're right. I mean, it's a simplification, but we can say the single treatment time point could be seen as a treatment period. Something happens on this time point. Here, we said it was just the one point where suddenly 80% of the cells die. Right? That's fine, but that could be kind of in a period of the treatment administration, where in the end we know that we eliminated in the end of the treatment, by the end of the treatment we eliminated 80% of the tumor cells, and that's where we start, right? So this is a single point here, but that could be also like a time period. But that's for the demonstration purpose, I would say. But that's absolutely right. They could be right.
Could you, as biologists,
Ross, I think, do you mean this?
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we observe certain effect, that's what I want to say, right?
Yeah.
Whether it's on a period of time, whether it's just one period, there's a certain effect in the end.
But it's not assume that the drug has effect on all the stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, or
I think what she said is the theta. You interpret the theta of
yes.
that model. Yeah.
Yes. I think the same for when you do experiments in mice, probably. No, or experiments on populations of people, they are sensitive.
Yeah. They can have like a certain mutation which makes them sensitive to the frequency.
Yeah.
On this particular subgroup is responding, but on the population level may not observe the effect, but in this particular subgroup there is
so
effect. So it could be, that's right. So that's actually the way it's called, like it's proportional sensitivity to the therapy. Sensitive to the therapy means they're sensitive, right? So that's...
there is an effect.
There's an effect. That's a part of the population where we observe the effect. The dynamics of the effect is another issue, right? Whether the effect is just observed immediately or whether it's delayed over time. Anyway, so this is the model, if you want to kind of simulate it if you want to simulate it, right? So you observe, that's how the growth model looks like. So here we got growth inhibition model and the full growth inhibition model, yes? In these two lines, the solid red and the dotted red, and we got just inhibition model, which pretty much, if we come back to this plot, that's pretty much covers different dynamics we observe down here, at least in my opinion, right? We got this just growth, inhibition and regrowth, another inhibition and regrowth after with this kind of reflection point later, the longer time to the reflection point, the shorter time to the reflection point, or we just got the inhibition, so full response to the treatment, right? So out of this model, we can figure out at least four different efficacy measures. So for example, let's say we got two different treatment arms. We can compare the growth or the regrowth rates. We can compare time to the regrowth, we can compare the inhibition rates, and as well as the fraction of the cells sensitive to the treatment. So this is the model, which kind of speaks biology, but also gets some good, it's a good candidate for statistical analysis. So we can do both. Where this model come from? So it comes from basically from the clinical applications. So the Stein paper I've mentioned about. It's about phase two clinical study for the prostate cancer, where they observe PSA levels, prostate specific antigen, right? And as a surrogate for the overall survival. So at least they observe some kind of correlation between PSA level and the overall survival. Right? So they say, well, we got our PSA, which kind of goes down once the treatment gets administrated, and then it goes up. The lower PSA could mean in this case there is a response. PSA is easy to measure. You need just urine sample or it's a blood sample. I think it's just a blood sample. And then you can observe by PSA, you can see some kind of like a response to the treatment. So they say, well, observing PSA, we need to have some kind of model for the PSA dynamics, and then you can say growth rate, inhibition rate, is there any correlation with the overall survival? So that's basically where they come from. So tumor volume or the biomarker growth in clinical applications, and then as endpoints, and then kind of correlation with some other endpoints, in this case overall survival. The list of these papers are basically all oncology applications in prostate cancer, renal cell cancer, cervical cancer, and up to the I'm really kind of happy with this publication in Lancet 2017, because that means this model attracts the attention. When they do a really wide study, so take these, I don't know, 10 different clinical trials and see the PSA levels, whether it's, how does it correlate with the overall survival, and use our model. But model in this version, because there is no cell death if you want to see the, look at the PSA level, any other biomarker, right? So this model is taken into account, and yeah, well, so that means there is a recognition for this model. So what I'm doing, it's a first time application in a preclinical environment where we can see some potential for this model. So what they say about the implementation of the model, right? What about time now? How much time do we
have? As much as you need. What?
20 to 9.
Time now
it's almost 1 hour. Anyway, so implementation of the model. So they come up with the model and say how we can implement the model. So what they do, basically, there is a R package pretty much used in all of these papers, right? Or this methodology is pretty much used in all of these papers, where they take the data. Here are the example three treatments from my example. Yeah, so I take this, out of these treatments, I take three of them just for the demonstration purpose. So we got placebo, ADC1 high dose, and ADC1 low dose, right? So this is placebo, this is a high dose, this is low dose on the same treatment. So now they say, take each of these individual tumor volumes and fit each of these models, right? Each of these models. So growth inhibition, just growth, and then full growth inhibition model. See which one is significant. Means all of the parameters are significant. If you find one, take it. If you find two models with all parameters significant, choose the one with the higher FIK criteria. There could be also situations when there is no model. So basically, these are the situations where they list four different reasons for that. So if there is no data for the patient, if there are only two observations and the difference between them is 20% tumor volume, only two tumor volume readouts and difference is 20%, there is more than two, but three of them got the same value, or first observation, the last observation equals zero, which makes sense because we can't really divide by zero if you want to calculate the rates or the normalize the tumor volume. Or if we can't really fit the model, right? So none of these models gives all significant parameters. Then we can say we end up with this no model outcome, which means we don't fit any model to the data. So how does it work in practice? So we got 10 animals in the placebo arm, 10 animals in the low dose, 10 animals in the high dose row, yes? So for each of them we fit the model. So as you see, for the placebo, majority of the cases they've been fitted with this growth only model here. It makes sense. We've just observed growing here. One of them being fitted by the growth and inhibition model. I don't see any sort of inhibition here, but that's the model that's been fitted. So basically they fitted the first model, was the best one. In the other cases, just growth model. For the low dose, so basically for this sort of scenarios, when you get inhibition and the rate and the growth, they've been fitting mainly GI model and full GI model with different growth and different inhibition rates. Sometimes they've been fitting the full model, so basically the model with the cell death. And then in the high dose, they've been basically find the just only inhibition models as the best ones, right? The ones which been performing best. Later on, what we can do, we can build some kind of, we can check distribution of these parameters. So this is the placebo, this is the high dose, and this is the low dose. And compare the medians. So do some man-weighted non-parametric testing and see whether there is a significance between the values. So for example, if you got the growth rate, right? Growth rate for the median for the placebo, and we compare the low dose level, so 0.036 versus 0.036 0.38 versus 0.011, whether there is a statistical significance between them. And there is a statistical significance, it means the efficacy, yes. we assign some p-value to this, to the difference between this growth rates between this low dose and the placebo, and the difference is significant. The same for the inhibition rate. Basically, what we can compare is this high dose and the low dose levels, so 0.061 for the high dose, 0.047 for the low dose, and the p-value is 0.82, so it's not significant difference. So inhibition, so growth inhibition, it's not statistically different in these two treatment arms. So that's kind of how we, that's where we can get with this for the time being. And that's a framework they proposed, right? That's a framework. It's not mine. That's what they say. That's the way we can implement this model. Why we do it? We want to find the best model within the treatment arm. We want to fit the individual tumor volumes and then see whether they some kind of are close. So we got growth rate for each tumor volume within treatment arm, and we want to look at the distribution. So if they are close to each other, it will be pretty kind of, you know, tight distribution.
I thought it's more reliable to find the maximum likelihood given you randomized initially to the group, so the animal should be similar, and therefore that one to find what's the most likely response.
What's the overall kind of, what's the overall model for the treatment arm, right? Yes, yes, that's exactly what I'm doing in the next step. But that's what they propose, and that's what the R package is doing. It gives you the fit for the individual tumor volume lines. So they go up to this point, actually. This one is mine. So yeah, if you got the individual values, what we can do, we can take the distribution of these values, aggregate them over the treatment arms, and do some kind of like a statistical testing to make it kind of applicable for the biologists, right? So the scientists take the application, shiny app, fit the models, take the rates, build the distributions, and do the statistical testing. And at least they got some kind of p-values which allow them to say, well, this is significant, this is not significant. There's this more efficacious, this is less efficacious. So we got just one tumor, median growth rate for this treatment arm, and then we got the growth rate for inhibition rate for this treatment arm, and we got inhibition rate for this treatment arm. So we can say, for example here, in the high dose, inhibition is stronger than in a low dose, but this difference is not statistically significant. In placebo, growth is stronger, or let's say it's more than three times, it's almost four times stronger than in a low dose level, right? So here, and the difference is statistically significant. So that's allows to translate the outcomes into statistical language. Is it okay? So is the answer to the question?
Well, partly, you know, animal which has three data points has got less information than an animal which has got 20 data points.
Yeah.
But probably that knows.
Yeah, yeah, sure. I mean, that's a starting point. We can do some kind of, you know, some imputation here, let's say loss observation carried forward, and then that's what happens normally. So we take, for example, here and leave it on the same level up to the end of the study.
Yeah,
that's a practice. That's what happens in a kind of preclinical drug development. They take loss observation carried forward to fill up your sample, or they can do some kind of, you know, time when it's doubles or triples, and then you got time to the effect, time to the particular event analysis. Here, that's what we can do. That's one of the ways. But there are, I agree, there are plenty of other ways we can wait particular cases and such that, you know, just to discriminate between the different amount of information they contribute to the analysis. I agree. But that's for now, and I would say I don't like it that much. What I can tell you, I mean, if you wanna, I've done the analysis for the study, so I fitted all of, so we got the fit for all of this kind of tumor volumes within these three trials. If you take the median growth, so let's say this is we fit the growth model with median growth now for the placebo, and then we construct another model with let's say growth inhibition model for the growth inhibition cases, mediums from a low dose level, and then we fit the just inhibition model for the high dose. That's what we end up with if you take mean squared error. So basically take these models, selected models, feed them to the data, take the errors, so take the models, select the median values of the parameters within arms, take the errors, so basically differences between the model value and the tumor volume value, take the mean of these differences, squared differences. That's what we end up with. So inhibition model, so these are the models selected by the algorithm within the package. Inhibition models, pretty good performance. Growth inhibition models, pretty good. It kind of works less, it's kind of doesn't work that good in just growth models, yes, as well as full model, if the full model gets selected.
When you say the model is selected by the package,
mm-hmm. So if
does that mean that the model, sorry, the package fits different models to the data?
That's right.
And then chooses the one
that's
which
right.
fits best?
That's exactly what happens here. Yeah, so we take each individual tumor volume and fit all of this model to this particular trajectory. Yes, so this trajectory gets four different models fitted. And of course, if it qualifies, right? So if there is a kind of, you know, if the data are robust enough to fit the model, right? So if see which models fits best, and this model gets chosen. So for this tumor volume, let's say number one, placebo, growth and inhibition model was selected. So basically this model, because we had, this model was basically all significant for this particular tumor volume. For the other tumor volumes within this placebo arm, only growth models turned out to be the best. Situation slightly mixed. In the low dose arm, where we got basically always growth inhibition model or the full growth inhibition model, which gets reflected in the parameter. So for example, for tumor volume 11, we got this model selected because it has growth and inhibition. The same for tumor volume 12. For tumor volume number 13, we got this model selected as the best one. The same for the 14, 15 just growth inhibition model, 16 full model, growth inhibition, and full model, and growth inhibition. Yep, so I would say growth inhibition model, growth inhibition, full model, growth inhibition, full model. These are the models assigned to the individual treatments. So now I take this individual tumor volumes. Now I take this tumor volumes, fit the model. I take all the study, right? All the study data, not just only these three treatments, but all the study data. Yes, all these arms, right? So I fit the model to all of them. For each arm, I take the median value for each of this. For each of the tumor volumes. So it's not on the treatment level. So each of the tumor volumes, I fit the best default, the selected model. I take the mean squared error for this model, and I present it in a form of I present it on this plot. Yes. So inhibition tumor volumes been doing well. Growth inhibition been doing well. Growth and full model have been doing less well. So I checked what's going on. So selected the tumor volumes where the full model was selected, and that's what's going on. Black is empirical value, red is the other model outcomes. So as you see, in this algorithm applied in the R package, for the full GI models, some of them downgrade the growth rate. So the fit, it's not good. So the optimizer doesn't work. That's what happens in this package. Another problematic model being growth. So I checked what's going on for the growth. So for the growth, as you see, the growth itself is not always going up in an exponential way. Yes, so for example here, we've got the same values kept, but the model itself is exponential type, so that's why we don't get this perfect fit, because the growth itself is not always purely kind of exponential. It's kind of staircase. So we see this kind of, you know, staircases, right? So it's flat, goes up, flat, goes up, flat, goes up. So once you feed the exponential model, exponential curve, naturally the fit won't be perfect, right? So that's what's going on. And so that's, please bear in mind, because I come back to this outcomes. So just to sum up where we are so far. So we got this model, which basically speaks biology, which is kind of working for statisticians as well. What's good about that? So it's easy to interpret, it's easy to apply. There is a package, there's an R package, there's a Shiny app. To apply this model, we just need to plug in the data, right? What is not good is we got four different competing models, right? So, and plus no model outcome. It's fine if you want to do this kind of single experiments, but it's not that good if you want to go for the larger scale. For example, I don't really like this kind of low dose outcome, because basically I got like two different models which kind of mix up for this arm.
Yeah, but if you look at the pi values, are very, very close to one.
Yeah, that's right. So we got, but that's, yeah, that's a different model, right? So I got my low dose arm, which basically gets represented by two different models, right? So for some of them I got my phi, for some of them I don't. This is just one arm. In the future I'm going to be interested in efficacy of this arm versus something else. So I need some sort of consistency. I need some sort of consistent framework, which some common modeling framework which could be applied and will work. Not like a four different models and I just pick up one and then I say, well, this is, there is no consistency. So I would say this is not good for this methodology. So there are some numerical problems, but it's just optimizer, right? So we can change it, we can fix it, right? Last but not least, the data itself has a longitudinal structure, so it's cross-section over time. Yeah, so I got my grouping factor, which is a treatment. So I don't want to really look at this individual, because there is a methodology already which allows me to take them all into account into some kind of mixed effect modeling, right? Which is more sound from a statistical point of view, more powerful, you could say so. So what are the alternatives to this framework, to this particular framework, when we kind of, to this particular framework? I call it like a frequentist framework, but that's my reference. Yes, there's nothing else. There's no other way to implement this model, so I want to say, take this one, I take this one as a reference, I want to do something else. So what is this something else? So I want to go for some kind of mixed effect modeling framework, that's one thing, and choose one model which will be fit to all this kind of experimental data I'm dealing with. Not like a four different models, but just one model, fit all of them and see what comes up, right? I tried to do it in a frequentist framework, so following this R packages, but I couldn't really find the converging. I didn't have that much time to kind of play with this model. And so I said, well, maybe I should try something else. And I tried to go for the Bayesian estimator, see how it goes. I want to do some kind of like a batch processing, which I'm going to tell you more about later on. So I wouldn't really kind of play with this kind of converging problems, starting values problems, variance covariance matrix choice, and so on, because I wanted something which just works. Bayesian framework. So probably most of you are pretty familiar what Bayesian methodology is all about. So it's all about some kind of like a finding a posteriori distribution given some sort of prior knowledge. Okay? So we operate on the distributions, parameter distributions now, and so and that's the way we get to this distribution, that's a priori distribution. So sometimes functions here, this likelihood or prior distributions, are available in a closed form. Sometimes they don't, and we need some kind of sampler, which allows us to sample from a distribution. So we call this Markov chain Monte Carlo samplers. There are different samplers. Overall, quality of the fit is assessed by visual analysis. See, for example, if the chains are mixing, right, or if they don't mix. Right? We like this sort of situation because we know the model, the chain is converging and it's, or it's mixing well, such that distributions, a priori distributions, is some kind of robust. Later on, we take the mean and cut out 95% credibility intervals, and that's our outcome, right? And Bayesian methodology is applied in all of majority of this. Computer statistical packages, Winbox, JAX, STAN, SAS, right? I've chosen JAX in my application, and these are the two models I chosen. So basically I've chosen the GI model and the full model, because I'm dealing with this oncology data, so I wanted to have this death rate in my analysis. So I'm going to consider I'm going to fit, since you remember the situation, the model was not the full GI model in this tuned GR framework, in this R package framework, it did not work well. So I want to first consider my Bayesian estimator for the individual tumor volume data, and then also do it on this tumor level, I call it tumor level, which is alternative to tuned GR approach. And I want to do it on the treatment level as well, when I fit just one function for the treatment group, right? Which kind of has this parametric form as a growth GI model or a extended GI model. Right, so I did it for this particular study, for the selected treatments. So again, we got placebo, high dose, low dose levels. So these are the fits, right? So this is the fit Bayesian model for the full GI model for placebo arm. Now fit for the low dose arm and fit for the high dose arm. For me they look good. I'm happy, yes, at least I can kind of, you know, quantify what's going on in the placebo and the other treatment arms. This is the, as you see the model, the chains are mixing well. The final posterior distribution is not always symmetric. That's why I take the medians as a representative values for the parameters. And that's what we observe. So placebo arm, low dose, high dose. As you see, for the placebo, phi is really low. So it means none of the cells died. It's pretty close to zero. And that's the value. So it's pretty much kind of precise. So a posterior distribution is not. So this dot here, there is a credibility interval, but it's so narrow you can see it, right? You can see it slightly wider for the low dose, and again pretty narrow for the high dose. Yes. So that's pretty much reflects what we see. That reflects what we think it's supposed to be, right? Higher death rate for the high dose, slightly lower death rate for the low dose, and there is a very almost zero death rate for the placebo arm. Inhibition again. So as you see, I got values for each of these parameters now because I fit the same model to all of these treatments. So for inhibition, the highest inhibition for the high dose makes sense, slightly lower for the low dose, yes, inhibition, and 0.011 inhibition for the placebo, where there is no inhibition. However, as you see, this a posteriori distribution is really wide. It's not precise. So I would say, for this sort of outcomes in the full GI model, this parameter takes the role. This parameter takes the role whenever there is no inhibition. So inhibition here is completely useless, the outcome. Could be everywhere between 0 and 0.75. Because that's the weight, it gets outweighted by the very low death rate. So there is no inhibition. Even though we see some kind of value, we see some distribution, but the inhibition part in this model, it's pretty much outweighted. Sorry, it's pretty much outweighted. It's zero times the inhibition. So we could have whatever here, right? That's one thing. When we go to the growth parameter, that's really tricky, and that's embarrassed me by the first, because by the first kind of, you know, by the first time I've seen this result, because, as we see, for the growth, we got placebo and low dose almost the same, 0.039, 0.032, which means the growth, it's pretty much the same with both arms, which is not the case. But again, we got pretty high death rate here, so the growth element, it gets outweighed by the inhibition, right? The same as happened for the placebo arm for the inhibition case. But the a posteriori distribution, it's pretty narrow, so something is going on. What I expected, what I would kind of expect, is like here, low growth, high inhibition, and high growth, a high death rate as a, for a high dose. So this way I would kind of expect like a high growth, low inhibition. About inhibitions, I would expect kind of, you know, low growth here, right? But the growth rates are kind of the same. Then what came to me is what this really model does. And I think that's okay. That's okay, because this model reflects some kind of biology. What's really going on? Yes, there is a high death rate, but whatever remains is growing on a pretty much the same rate as a placebo. So there is no guarantee that the living tumor cells will grow at a smaller rate. They still grow the same rate, but the amount of the cells is smaller, right? Which is gets reflected here, 0.9 rate fraction of the dead cells.
I'm quite getting that, but I think you are missing another parameter, and it's that the inhibition doesn't act from the very beginning. So your parameters are trying to balance each other in order to do that.
Yeah.
Probably you should have in the time content of the inhibition, you should have something that will tell you that
For the time being, I just want to see the kind of shape of these dynamics, right? And so that's kind of was pretty much confusing me. How should I interpret this high growth where there is almost no growth? There is slightly regrowth, but not at the rate as we observe. So probably that's the way the model works. Yeah. So high volume of the dead cells, the remaining cells still regrow at the rate as if they are in the placebo. So that's kind of outcome from the growth full growth model. If you look at this GI model without this death rate, the results are more consistent, right? So we can see, of course, there is no fine because we don't consider it into the model. It is pretty much the same, as you see this kind of, you know, yeah, the fit to the model fits. It's slightly different low dose outcome. And they're pretty much more consistent from let's say statistical point of view. So growth 0.39, lower growth, like a three times or the four times lower growth for the low dose, and almost no growth, zero growth for the high dose level. Inhibition, zero inhibition for placebo, 55 slightly. So 0.064 for the high dose, and slightly lower inhibition for the low dose. Kind of makes sense to me, yeah? They reflect a posteriori distributions, narrow, I would say. That's kind of pretty nice. Nice results which I kind of understand, which kind of makes sense. If you put these three models' outcomes into account, you see that GI model in the Bayesian framework gave me pretty much the same outcomes as a tube GR if I take the medians from the package. Yes, 0.39, 38, 10, 11, 55, 47, 64, 61. 0.015, but that's because there is only one observation. So that's a median and the observation itself. So yeah, once versus zero. So as you see, GI model is working almost the same. I got almost the same as a tube GR, right, from the package. Now let's have a look at the in-sample FITNA. What's going on? You remember this picture, if you kind of forget for a moment about these two plots, these two figures. You remember this picture. Full model and the growth model been working slightly worse in this package framework. Once we're going to the Bayesian framework, see what's going on here. Full model and full model work almost perfectly. That's the same as growth inhibition and inhibition. The same problem remains about the growth only model, yes? But that's, as you remember, this kind of stairwise pattern of the tumor volumes within the growth within this let's say growth only arms tumor volumes, growth only tumor volumes. So yeah, I see. Yeah, Bayesian estimator eliminated the problem of this full full model mismatch. Yeah.
I have a question. Can you use these models according to different types of problems?
Types of the problems like. Well, different behaviors, at least as far as we are, let me come back to, as far as we are operating within this sort of kind of patterns, right? So when we got this just growth, inhibition and regrowth. But this are kind of like a standard patterns. So I would say, yeah, if we kind of, it doesn't really work if you got the situations where, for example, it's flat for some time and then goes down, goes up, goes down again. So that's, we need to find something else for if the patterns are not patterns like here, right? Then we need to find some other modeling or kind of forget about modeling and simply concentrate on some kind of time point and say, well, pattern itself, it's too difficult to end up with some model which is going to give us reasonable endpoints, right? Endpoint like a growth rate. If the pattern is like this, I can't really say about the growth because there is a growth and inhibition and growth again. So this model fits this particular kind of something. If we expect something like this, which pretty much kind of is intuitive, so we can say, well, some of the treatments will not respond. Yes, so it will be just growth. Some of the treatments will respond fully, so it will be just inhibition. Some of the treatments will respond in the beginning and then regrow, which will be kind of growth inhibition model.
So I mean, for example, if you have a population of cells in growth, cells which are inhibited and others which grow, so there are different dynamics, so you can apply different
types. Yeah. So then you can say, well, let's apply growth inhibition model them separately and see what comes out.
Yeah, predominance of behavior.
Maybe say, for example, cell death rate will be higher in one of this one subgroup compared to the other one. You can say, well, that's the pattern, right?
One exception for this trend nowadays is immunotherapies, where action comes a bit later, so it goes up like that, and then suddenly after halfway through, it just starts to slow down.
Yes. So they're like it's like a time to something, right? Time to reflection, where it starts kind of, you know. First of all, it's going up, and then, I know what you mean. So there's here is a treatment that still goes up, but the treatment, the effect itself is kind of delayed, right? It goes down later on. So yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it could be kind of, you know, time to, first growth and then inhibition and maybe regrowth again, right? Yeah, so this. But for that, we need some kind of model which takes into account this.
Find the average inflection point and then model it the same way. Something like that.
Yeah, or this kind of delayed time of the response. Mm. So let me continue. So, as you see, my Bayesian framework eliminated the problems of the full model, right? And so now, if you take, yeah, so that's the same. That's the same picture. So this is a Bayesian outcome for the full, for the cases where the full GI model been selected. This is the fit Bayesian. This is the fit we know already, right? About the growth is pretty much the same, so that's why we got pretty much the same performance. Now, this study is part of the bigger program called Antibody Drug Conjugates, developed within MedImmune by Spirogen, Spirogen company. Antibody Drug Conjugate, very briefly about this treatment, is an oncology treatment designed for now and developed for now for the oncology, as oncology treatment. What's, do you know antibody drug conjugates? You know about it. Right, so it's basically, I'm correct me if I'm wrong, this treatment has like three different elements. So the drug, yes, so the molecule or, yeah, the molecule, the compound has like three different elements. Has a antibody, has a warhead, and has a something which kind of links them together, right? Antibody, the role of the antibody is to trap the tumor cells, avoid harming the other types of the cells. So antibody gets attached to the tumor cell. Once it gets attached, releases the warhead, which kills the tumor. So it's some kind of like a targeted therapy. It has three elements. So as you see, as you may expect, the design of the studies is basically about linking different antibodies with different warheads and different conjugation sites. Right, so three different, so like a combination. If you get, if you say, if you get 10 different antibodies, get 10 different warheads, and we got different 10 different conjugation sites, then in theory we can have 1,000 different antibody drug conjugates. Right? Of course, we can't really check, design, organize, like run experiments for all of these combinations. We need to find some kind of way to predict efficacy of the antibody. That was the question from the scientists. So they say, we developed this, we got already, we carried out, we got 17 different antibodies, so we got 30 different payloads for these warheads, 8 conjugation sites, so that gives us 4,000 different combinations. Yes, if, of course, not all of them are feasible, that makes sense from biological point of view, but at least they are theoretically possible, right? For the time I was working on this study, on this topic, they had 38 in vivo efficacy studies. So they simply took some of these combinations and ran the experiments on these combinations. So 63 different ADCs, which we ended up with 147 different treatment lines and 2,300 individual tumor volumes and 28 different cancer cell lines. So see, it's kind of complicated and it's wide, pretty wide program, right? So what I've decided to do is just take all of this data and fit my models for all of these experiments. So pretty kind of, you can say in this modern language, we have large database or big data and we try to see some kind of, yeah, what we may get, how we can apply statistics to predict the efficacy of the antibody drug conjugate, or at least some, get some kind of clue what's going on from, let's say, modeling point of view, what sort of dynamics we observe, what sort of similarities, right? So I thought my model could be a pretty good candidate to apply, to build some kind of landmark of what's going on within this whole database. I fitted my models, so basically I used the package, I used my full GI model, I used my GI model only, right? So everything on the tumor level, so I was not doing my mixed effect modeling for the treatment groups, but I was fitting individual tumor volumes and looking for the median outcomes within the treatment arms for each parameters, for growth, inhibition, and death, cell death. So if you run on this, if you run the package, right, the methodology from a package, using the package, that's what you end up with. Full models, these are the mean of the mean squared errors, so I take the mean errors within the mean squared errors for the tumor volumes, and then take the means within the treatment arms. So within the model selected model class, right? So mean of the mean squared error. So it completely fails. So it kind of gets confirmed that TMGR methodology just completely fails for the full model framework. Works in expectable way in a growth, again because of the growth patterns we observe, worked pretty well with growth inhibition, and of course doesn't give me any fit for no-model cases. Then if you see what's doing the Bayesian estimator, it's fix the full model problem, fix the no-model problem. As you see, I pretty like this fits the Bayesian model is providing. The same happens for GI, except for GI the full model outcomes are slightly worse than in GI model the full model outcomes are slightly worse than the full GI model. I guess it's because of the richer parametric structure. GI model has three parameters. This model has full GI model has the three parameters, GI model has only two parameters. So basically, by nature, in-sample fit will be better for the model with richer parametric structure. So I think that's the kind of my explanation for the performance, for the slightly worse performance for the full model. But it's still not bad, I would say, right? I still like this model, the GI model performance.
What do you do with the no model? What is it that you do for no model?
I just take everything, fit models to the cases where there was no model selected. Okay. So I just ignore, I just let it go. That's my idea. I mean, that's why I told you in the beginning I didn't want to play this frequentist mixed effect modeling, because I couldn't find easily convergence of my models. With the Bayesian, I just let it go. The computer was running for the day and night for 7 days, right? And then I found this result. So I didn't really, I was a bit lazy here. I just wanted to see what's going to happen. And that would happen. So I think it's doing pretty well looking at the quality of the fit, right? So no model selection, model selection, whatever. Everything gets fit. And I got my, it's like, you know, in the real case applications, I got my database, plug in the database and come back after 1 week and see what comes out without any kind of, you know, concentrating on any single experiment, just kind of like a batch processing for the database. Yeah?
The other thing you could do in the frequentist approach is to fit a mixed model that allow for individual level heterogeneity.
That could be probably something. I would come back to the frequencies if the Bayesian doesn't work. For me, Bayesian was just, I just wrote the code in JAX. I checked it for some experiments. I've seen it was kind of converging. And I just came back and find my outcomes. Of course, it's something, yeah, more things could be done, right? I could probably even more improve this outcomes, kind of make my samplers more robust and so on. But yeah, that's what came in the first step, let's say. So I like these outcomes. So just a couple of comments about what we, because you see that, sometimes the growth rate outcomes versus in the GI model versus growth rate outcomes in the TuneGR model, in this frequentist methodology. So I checked the cases where just model fits by GI, the growth models, right? Growth models only fit by GI model and by TuneGR, what I call them like a frequentist, freak. So freak MMSC, bigger than Bayesian MMSC fit, and the other way around. So this is MMSC and the cases where the growth model being selected, right? So you can see for the same kind of tumor, this is the model, this is the Bayesian. So in red, you see the cases where the Bayesian is doing better, and you see it's doing much better, right? So you see the changes are rather significant, or even not kind of the same levels. There are cases where the differences are not that great, but there are cases where the Bayesian is improving a lot, right? This is the Bayesian MMSC, this is the frequentist MMSC. For the cases where Bayesian is working worse, you can see that the differences are not that spectacular as for the other case. Yeah, so yes, Bayesian is doing providing slightly worse MMSC, but the difference is it's rather not significant, and it happens for much all of these blue cases, right? Blue cases are almost flat, where the red cases are almost in favor of the Bayesian, in favor a lot for the Bayesian. So if you look at the growth, I told about this growth rate. So now we can see if you take the median growth rates for the Bayesian versus for the same tumor volumes, frequencies growth rates for four different model selections. Of course, there is no inhibition model here. I mean, it's kind of came by default for this legend, but it's not included because in inhibition model there is no growth rate to consider. Yeah, so it's only these three, full model, growth inhibition model, and growth model, and you can see that, as you can see, that the Bayesian is usually providing the higher growth outcomes, in particular for the full model. It's providing the better fit. Yes, so you can say that it's doing better job. So probably the problem looks like the problem is about the growth rate estimation for frequentist package, which is, I would say, important drawback, because normally if we kind of consider tumor volume outcomes, we first think about the growth rate, right? So the growth rate is not estimated that well, that precise. If it's not precisely estimated, then it's not good, I would say. So I'm happy with this Bayesian methodology. It improved in that matter.
The one thing that is confusing is that when you divide incidence into four groups, what you mean is the performance of these models in what used to be the group of the full model and in what used to be the Gregorian amount for the group.
Yeah.
So you are only fitting one model to everything.
Yes, that's right. One model, one platform. So for every tumor I got growth, inhibition, and rate and the death rate. It's not like I don't have like a four different models again. I don't want. That's what I want. I want to have one standard framework. Framework in form of the growth inhibition model or the full growth inhibition model. So I always, for every tumor volume, I can describe every tumor volume using the same set of parameters. That was my idea. Common framework for all of the analysis. Because then we can speak the same language, right? So this, here is the growth rate, here is the growth rate, here is the inhibition, here is the rate of the death rate. Yes, so I specify each of them in the same set of, in the same domain, basically. Specify dynamics of each tumor volume in the same domain. Right, so that was the tumor level fit, so individual tumor volumes. Here are the outcomes, here is the landmark for treatment levels. So basically mixed effect models. Mixed effect models where they got death rate, growth rate, inhibition rate from the full GI model. So as you see, there is, you remember this case with this inhibition and white posteriori distribution. Looking at the whole kind of, whole database, that's the case. So I would say once you consider this full GI model, and you got don't take inhibition into account because its role gets taken by the death rate. Yeah. So growth, yes, and death rate are taken as a characteristics for the full GI model. Yeah.
I'm just trying to what's the difference in your understanding between inhibition and death?
You mean the talking about death rate, right?
I'm slightly confused. What is phi parameter? Maybe this is proportion of responding cells, as it was mentioned. Some cells might be just normal cells; they never die.
So inhibition is the rate of clearance. So the rate at which that part of the tumor gets cleared.
Is it phi?
Yes. Yes, it's not phi. It's not phi. Phi is the fraction of the affected cells.
So let's say if you consider that half of the tumor, it's not xenografts by the tumor, half of it is stroma, half of it is tumor, then we can say phi is 50%.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Half of them, and that's the weight for the observed inhibition. I don't fully understand this model. I take it as a granted, right? It's given by biologists, and I try to make some kind of sense out of this model.
Because sometimes when you say inhibition,
yes,
and death rate, and sort of play with this
death rate, it's a bit kind of, when you think about death rate, it's this fine. So the fraction of the dead cells or sensitive to the treatment cells. So
I
it's not
the terminology.
Death rate is fine.
But death rate, probably you've been exposed to death with biologists. If I say that, simplifying, death rate is percent of apoptosis, will it do?
Yeah.
Okay, so we compare apoptosis, compare proliferation, this is standard of law,
yeah,
and compare proportion of tumor cells.
All right, yeah.
Yeah. Because when you say inhibition, that's sort of...
Inhibition is dynamics, right? Inhibition is dynamics over time. It's a rate over time.
Sorry,
phi is the rate, it's a fraction, it's a static number.
Yeah, could I suggest one thing? You could call phi death proportion.
Death proportion, sorry. Is it the death rate here? It's just ignore it. It's a legacy from my previous analysis. I call it death rate, but it's phi, it says
it's
proportion of the cells.
Proportion of dead cells.
Yeah, yeah, of dead cells.
I don't like saying that phi is proportion of dead cells. I don't like it because you assume that these are dead cells, that is standard proportion. It could be stromal cells that contribute to the volume of tumor. They are not dead. They are not going to
be. We are not talking about tumor here, we are talking about xenograft.
About xenograft.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I don't know if they have stromal. I
don't know either. I just kind of feel.
Phi could depend on time. Phi should be function of time.
Well, the assumption of this model is that the effect of the treatment is instantaneous. So either kill the cell,
yeah,
or it doesn't at all.
Yeah. So they get affected or they don't get affected. 0-1. If they get affected, they shrink, they die, they get cleared, some kind of. Cleared on the inhibition rate, which basically contributes to the tumor volume you observe.
But inhibition rate is the speed of clearance of dead,
yes,
cells.
That's right.
Okay, I just tried to understand.
It's a clearance rate.
Yeah.
Clearance rate, yeah, some kind.
It's a decrease of volume of the
clearance rate.
Yes.
If phi is proportional to the...
Fraction.
Relative can be fraction. Yeah,
yes.
Fraction, that's it.
Yeah.
So the rate is clearance of that.
Yeah.
Dead cells.
Yeah.
But obviously when you call clearance of dead cells as death rate,
death rate, ignore, this is the legacy from my previous analysis, I call it death rate, but it's phi. It's not rate, of course, it's just cell death fraction.
The mathematically, in terms of modeling, your approach is much better than whatever previous package did, because previous package didn't work in certain situations. But I think that the main barrier for listening to this, because I have both backgrounds, mathematical and biology, is currently is finding the right language. Thinking what exactly is in each parameter. I understand you can then find exactly what it is. Finding the right wording, which should explain this simplified.
Yeah.
I think the proportion of sensitive cells might be closer, I think. Sensitive cells.
Yeah. Rate of the responding cells, proportion of the responding cells,
sensitive cells.
It's not death rate, it's nothing about, there is no dynamics over time, it's just a fraction. So
the other thing is,
the
word regression, which had the original in the text,
yeah,
that is more explaining, regressing.
Yeah.
Not progressing.
Inhibition or
regression
versus inhibition.
Opposite is progression.
Yes.
And this is regression.
Actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I should change this kind of plot and say here is like a death fraction of the dead cells.
Because it's a good model, it's now time to understand what it says.
Yeah. Anyway, so time is running out.
Yeah, we're approaching.
We are approaching the end, so this is kind of, you know, as you see, the good, but just want to show you the picture. Inhibition is not that good if you kind of take this precision of this inhibition assessment. It's not that good if you take this dead cell fraction into account, right? It looks slightly better if you take the other model, GI model, yes? And that's the model So for this model, I'm using as a representation phi, which is the proportion of the dead cells, right? And growth. For this one, I take the growth and inhibition. So now I just put all of these outcomes and want to see what can I see in the whole database? How can I characterize certain subgroups of this treatment? So this is for this growth inhibition model. As you see, as you remember maybe first, there are two different types of treatments. Control, three different types of treatments. There is a control arm, which is like a placebo. Control treatments, which there is an intervention, but it's not expected to work. And there are treatments. Here, if you can see, certain rows are in red. I can't really disclose these treatment names to you. That's why they are so small. But there are real treatment names now, the real names of the antibody-drug conjugates. Black ones are the treatments, the real treatments. This low dose, high dose, yeah? Blue ones are the controls, and red ones are the controls as well. So as you see, basically, on this highest, on the lowest level of kind of, you know, separation, you see two different clusters, black and red. In the red one, as you see, all the treatments come together. If you take all these four characteristics into account, median overall survival, we observe, which is not that good measure given these are the controlled experiments. So overall survival is planned. So we're going to run the experiment up to day 20, up to day 100, right? It's not like in clinical trials, we let it go. The longer overall survival, the better for our treatment, right? They are finished. So overall survival is not that representative because it's pre-planned and different for each of experiments. Yes? But I put it here as another kind of, you know, contributor for my clustering, basically. So then I put Bayesian median growth. So I take from each of these treatments, I take the Bayesian median value for growth and median value for inhibition rate, and then calculate time to regrowth for each of these models and put them all together and look for the clusters. What comes out? What sort of subgroups I can see? So the first subgroups I can see are basically controls versus treatments. As you see, some of the rows are black here, which means they are treatments, which come together with the controls. So there is something inherent for these treatments such that they work in a similar way as the controls. But that's very low level of aggregation. If you go up, then you can see, or maybe very high level of aggregation. If you go down in our dendrogram, we see that there are different subgroups, and we can characterize them in a certain ways. So what was my intention? This is, you can say this is a draft, on the draft level now. I just want to see the first big picture of my database, such that later on I can say, since we got some antibody drug conjugates, three different elements, how, if you take different subgroups now, for example, the controls, the first level, controls versus treatments, what it's is there something inherent for this treatment such that they look like a controls? And what does it mean they look like a controls? As you see, the first landmark here is time to regrowth. It's lower in a control, let's say control cluster, compared to the treatment cluster. As you see, there is a reflection point here, kind of. If you look, in this subgroup within this controls, there is a subgroup which got pretty strong growth. Yes, so this kind of red one, so there's pretty strong growth with lower overall survival, right? Kind of. Yeah, so on this treatment arm, you see there is a highly responding, there is a strong inhibition, right? part, there is also strong time to longer time to regrowth compared to the mean. So there are different subgroups. My question is like, let's biologists have a look at it and see whether there is some sort of story behind this kind of clusters. If there is a story behind the clusters, you can see maybe there is some sort of elements of this treatment which make them to belong. Let's say, if here is a A, B, C, so maybe A, C, A, B, C, and here we can apply similar antibody, or we can replace the antibody part, this treatment ends up here, right, in different clusters. So maybe there are sort of inherent characteristics which kind of improve or affect significantly the grouping, the group the treatments falls in.
For that, you have to associate those measures to the different chunks. So you may have to say that the time to regrowth is related to the antibody sum. Yeah.
Absolutely. This is a draft. This is the first picture I want to see, and it's already some patterns emerge. That's my message. It's not finished. I didn't have time to finish this analysis, but that's where I stopped. And I could see, yeah, there is something going on. We can play with these parameters. Maybe don't take the four of them, but take on maybe two of them, see what sort of clustering. Start from the very low level, and then kind of extend and see what sort of how we can kind of affect. So build some kind of like a network analysis. See what is affecting what. And then maybe you can kind of help to specify some prior information for a future study designs in to be able to predict efficacy of theoretical antibody drug conjugate treatment. So that was my kind of idea. I did the same for the other model. Yes, again, you see some sort of patterns emerge. Again, we got pretty kind of nice separation between the control arm, as if you look at the red and black control under the treatment, but probably slightly different clusters. And that brings me to the end of my presentation. I think this is the summary. So. Thank you for your attention, for your discussion and questions, and that's where I like to stop. And I would like to acknowledge my colleagues from Medinin AZ, Abdullah Herat, Sivanovic, Harry Yank, and Franz Biogen, Conor Barry. So, as far as I know, this presentation will be available on the web.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I put the appendix here to kind of contribute to reproducibility of the results. So this is the kind of mixed effect model I've used, specification of the mixed effect model. This is symmetric variance-to-variance matrix. Here I didn't take the zero means. I've taken the means from the tuned GR outcomes. But I slightly kind of imputed the value, certain values. So the sort of kind of non-informative prior, but with informative mean. But non-informative variance-covariance matrix. So this is the model. This is the JAGS code. So you can see exactly what I've done here. What sort of priors I've chosen, and that's the way I kind of imputed the TUMGR outcomes to make them priors for my modeling. And this is the model for, this is the full GR implementation, right? And this is on the treatment level. This is on the treatment level. This is for you. And this is kind of some MCMC diagnostics, how we approach them. So this is something you want to see. But if we don't see it, we normally see something like this. What does it mean? It means there is autocorrelation, how we can diminish the autocorrelation. Probably I've put high thinning, right? Which kind of puts more burden of the sampler, because we need to sample more just to end up with this to generate this sort of posterior distribution. Yes, the sample size increases, overall sample size increases for the sampling, or the number of the samples increases, number of the sampled points from the distribution increases. Yes, if we increase the thinning value. As a solution to the migration to STAN with this Hamiltonian Monte Carlo, I've seen they're more kind of, the results are more robust to the autocorrelation in this, for this sample. So that's my study. What I've been doing, I've been basically visualizing, carried out visual analysis of my chains, whether they're mixing well. If they're mixing well, I kind of accepted. I've been accepting the results. And I see some kind of even this sort of kind of mixing could be kind of pretty much acceptable for me if I do it on a large scale level, right? And can't really control every treatment, but as I said, I just want to let them go and get results. So this brings me to the end of my presentation.
Thank you.
Brilliant.